You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love. Hi, everyone. I'm Rachel Bernstein from the Indoctrination Podcast, and I want to give you a quick heads up because I don't want you to miss something really special. Our next Patreon-exclusive Q&A is coming up on June 19th, and these sessions only happen every other month. Every time, the questions are so powerful, the conversations go deep, and the insights we share are things you won't hear anywhere else. If you've ever wanted to ask something about cults, something about your experience, something you've wanted to know that hasn't yet been answered out there, something you wanted to know about coercion, generally about manipulation, or the healing process after leaving a high-control group, this moment is for you. Question submissions end June 12th, so make sure your voice is part of it. Send your questions to indoctrinationshow@gmail.com and join us on Patreon so you don't miss out on this next Q&A. I'd really love to hear what's been on your mind. Take care.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Today on the show, I interview Alice Hines about her show, her podcast, Mind Games. And it is a podcast that is so interesting, where she and Zoe, her partner on the podcast, really get into talking about NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, which you're going to learn more about after hearing this interview with her. So there is this promise that NLP has, and it emerged in the 1970s in California, and then it kind of took over self-help in spite of its connection to an unsolved murder in the late 1980s, which is important to know about. NLP is kind of the secret sauce connecting life coach Tony Robbins, the Wolf of Wall Street, Jordan Belfort, and pickup artists like Ross Jeffries, as well as Nexium. And I think it's important that they're covering this because NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, is something that has helped a lot of people, but it also is something that can actually take control in a lot of ways. Alice is someone who has covered many stories, stories of groups that we care deeply about. As a journalist, she has done a deep dive into studying groups like Twin Flames Universe and Nexium, which, of course, here at the podcast, we value greatly. She has so many years of experience and has a lot of wisdom, and I love that she is covering this subject and that you get to hear from her. And our interview today is a bit shorter in length than often we have in our interviews. So my outro, my one more thing before you go, will be a little longer to compensate for the time, but also there's a lot to talk about on this subject. So here is Alice now. I am so happy to have Alice Hines with me today. It is an important discussion we're going to be having about something we haven't talked about yet, kind of surprisingly as I think about it, for the 6 years that the show has been happening. And it is so important to cover that there are methods of intervention, there are styles of therapy, of counseling modalities that are sometimes very, very helpful and sometimes potentially harmful. And it is important to know that as people move forward in their lives, that they might find themselves in a situation where they are unwittingly being manipulated and controlled. And it is especially important to me in my field that people not find themselves out of the frying pan into the fire when they are leaving a system that was unwittingly controlling them. And then when they go for therapy, the same thing could potentially be happening. So, Alice, welcome to the show. I'd love you to have a moment now to introduce yourself.
Sure thing. Thanks so much for having me, Rachel. My name is Alice Hines. I am an investigative journalist. I have covered a few different stories that may be of interest to your audience. One of them is the Twin Flames Universe story, the alleged internet cult that manipulated people's romances, marriages, and ideas of their own gender and sexuality. And my latest project, which I'm so excited to talk about, is the podcast Mind Games, of which I am a co-host with my good friend and the amazing journalist, Zoe Lascaz. And we are looking into neuro-linguistic programming, which is this therapy modality turned self-help, get rich, fix everything about your life type of program that really took off in the 1980s and has a very interesting therapeutic history, which we can absolutely talk about, but was also later adopted by the cult Nexium, which people have probably heard of, as well as the pickup artist movement. Those are the sort of speed seduction guys. You might remember Tom Cruise played one of them, kind of went on to create the larger manosphere. So these are some topics that we get into in our new podcast.
So wonderful that you have this podcast. And yes, our audience is familiar with Twin Flames. We've had a number of people who have been in it on the show. And I was interviewed by Wondery when they did their I think it was going to be a 6-part series on it. And then they contacted me to ask if I could be the 7th part of their 6-part series, which mathematically I realize doesn't quite line up, but they wanted to add an episode that discussed sort of the how and the why, how this can happen and why people get caught in these sorts of things, the mind games that exist there. And also with Nexium, very important group. And it is, you know, it's sort of textbook as we learn about people like Keith Raniere and others who were part of his staff and how it all came to be and how it all then fell apart. And also the fact that there are still some people who see him as this guru and messiah, even after he's done so many things that landed him in jail, and rightfully so. It's a fascinating thing to see how there is this weaving in I think, a way that falls under malpractice of psychotherapy techniques that cause people to feel like they're getting empowered, but all the while becoming disempowered. And so I'd love to talk to you more about, you know, NLP, what your interest is in it, and some of the things that I've noticed through the years that it does to people, knowing also that there are some people who use this practice with good intention, and they have found it to be helpful to them and helpful to their clients. But I think it's important to point out that it can also be used to cause people to bypass their conscious resistance. And that is a dangerous slippery slope in my field and in other people's fields as well. So I'd love, again, to hear what has drawn you to this topic.
Well, I'll answer your question, but I wanted to say I love the phrase you just used, bypass their conscious resistance. That's a very specific and nuanced way to describe coercion. And we encountered this a lot in the podcast because NLP was marketed as a sales technology to companies, to car salesmen, right? To people in the commercial sector who are constantly meeting resistance, understandably so, from people who don't want to separate from their money, right? So how do you, so is that coercion? Is that, you know, manipulation? What is that? But I really like the phrase you used. And to answer your question, what got me interested in NLP? Well, it was specifically this, the fact that it had been used for so many different purposes, like that it had these, for example, that one of the early mentors of Richard Bandler and John Grinder, the co-creators of NLP, was Virginia Satir, one of the pioneers of family therapy. Also, you know, Gregory Bateson, Milton Erickson. Milton Erickson was a psychiatrist and a pioneer of hypnotherapy, medical hypnotherapy. These were very high profile people who were interested in advocating for NLP in a therapeutic context. How interesting is that? Also, the creator of EMDR, the trauma therapy, trained in NLP before she went on to develop that method. So there were all of these positive aspects to NLP that were quite interesting, kind of things that were making me, you know, want to look at it more. But then there were these counterexamples of how groups as sinister as Nexium were, you know, using this to recruit people and just taking it so far beyond what some of those early mentors would have, you know, advocated for. So I felt like that spread of how differently it had been used was really interesting to me and to Zoe. So that was basically it. Yeah, that was why we wanted to do it. And then we saw no one had really done it. There's lots of information about NLP coming from practitioners, not a lot coming from journalists or people who are coming at it from a more neutral perspective, not trying to sell it, not trying to discredit it or be overly skeptical either. But we were both very interested in it for all of these reasons.
It's really fascinating. There, you know, I also am worried about practices where there really isn't a standard and there isn't an ethical kind of guideline used or developed for it, as powerful as it is, as transformative as it is, sometimes in positive ways, sometimes not. I know there was someone who came to me for counseling, actually, a number of years ago, who said, Most people would love this kind of trait. I happen to hate it. There is something about me where people listen to me. And I learned it, I think, from my narcissistic mother. And I found a way to grab people's attention. And I am not always aware that that's what I'm doing, but that I'm a Pied Piper. People will believe what I say, whether or not I actually know that what I'm saying is factual. And I have to be very cautious. And I've gone into doing different sorts of therapeutic techniques. And I started doing hypnotherapy and found that people went into trance-like states and took on whatever I said as the truth. And it stuck. And then I started doing NLP. And I had the same problem where it was interesting. He said that he was scared that it was legitimizing influence as a skill set because he already knew that he had influence over people and that it increased his sense of grandiosity and decreased his humility. I wrote this down when he said it because I thought that is fascinating for him to be so aware and so conscientious about it, which I think is a rarity, but that he could see the power that it held and the power that it gave him, and also how it kind of infected him and his psyche, which I think is fascinating to see.
Yeah, I think influence is something that can be positive, right? I think influence can be, it's one of these things that is, it's one of these sort of tools that often gets described as neutral. But I do think that's interesting that, and I think a question that is still something in my mind, like, is there something inherently corrupting about having such natural influence over people? Does that create a desire to increase one's influence? And could that be dangerous? I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
Right. There are some people who love the power of it. Other people, like this man who was actually a bit fearful of it. He said that he knew that he had a certain way that he could speak. He recorded himself a few times also to see what he did, and where he commanded whole rooms suddenly. And again, this is something that people would spend a lot of money, a lot of time to develop. And he just developed from watching it in his own household growing up. And he didn't like it. And so he decided to go into, he also loved to do art. He just like, never mind, I'm going to paint. Just going to do my own thing. Because when I talk to people, I kind of get into trouble as I see it with my own conscience. But I think that there is something interesting when people want to have that kind of power. So much of what people talk to me about after they've left cultic groups or after they've left systems like Nexium, like Twin Flames, like others, where they may have participated in recruiting people, in furthering the goals of the group by co-leading it and by taking on certain clients within the system to teach them how they were taught to teach them. And they leave sometimes having what we call moral injury. They have the sense that they did harm, again, without intending to, but that they gave them certain ideas that might not ultimately be helpful or healthy. It's hard to discern what is healthy or helpful, except that what I find is that if you check in with someone and you ask them, is this something that has helped your life? Is this something that has given you clarity or helped you fulfill whatever goals you came to me to achieve? Then great, we're on a good track. Of course, there's the social construct there where people might say they need to say yes to please you in order for you to like them. So I always sort of take that into consideration in those kinds of conversations. But still, what I find is destructive is when you find out or you kind of check in with a person and they're not really closer to achieving the goals and you blame them for it. Well, you're not doing it enough and you're not taking it seriously enough because this is the answer. This is the way that you're going to get there, wherever there is that you want to get. And so you just keep pushing them there. It's similar to meditation, similar to mindfulness practices. It works for a certain percentage of the population And with another percentage of the population, it actually can trigger their nervous system and make them more anxious, more depressed. And if you notice that happening, you need to have enough of a skill set, I think, to be able to shift with your client. But if you, again, think that NLP is the answer, you're going to keep pushing them in a way that I think ultimately will be destructive.
That's so interesting. Do you think that that can happen with any therapeutic method? It sounds like you're saying that's not exclusive to NLP.
Right. I think it can happen. I think what happens with people who learn about something like NLP and the power that it has is that sometimes that is what they learn to do. They might not have a variety of other kinds of modalities that they learn because sometimes it is presented as the best way. And so they are then going into working with people with limited capacity to be able to shift and to be able to go into a different direction. Like if you going to this kind of school program that I went to, you learn different modalities and you don't learn that one is necessarily better than another, which I think is a lot healthier in its presentation.
Right. That's super interesting. Yeah, I think I've definitely interviewed people for whom the strategy of emotional control that NLP teaches becomes a bit of second nature, to where you sort of can, it makes it hard to relate to your emotions without considering them within the context of the NLP vocabulary, right? So that's something that I've noticed with interviews that I've done too.
Oh, interesting. Wait, can you say more about that? What have you noticed in them?
I'm thinking of one interview in particular that actually wasn't in our podcast, but was with a young woman who began to use NLP sort of because her family would not support other forms of therapy. And she was friends with someone who was an NLP practitioner who got her into this group and, did an intensive training and learned some of these strategies of emotional control. And years later was describing the way, and I'm trying to remember exactly how she framed it, but so say something is making you angry. And I think one common NLP technique would be to sort of, you can kind of reframe it and think, am I choosing to be angry right now? And can I choose to have a different outcome? Seeing emotions as a choice is an element of NLP dogma that stuck with her, even though she intellectually recognized that maybe that wasn't always true or how she wanted to see the world. It continued to be an element of how she processed her own emotions.
Right. It's an interesting thing also about emotions being a choice. That is something that I see time and time again. You see it a lot in Scientology. You see it in large group awareness trainings. There's an unease with emotions. And I think that part of the reason is that in these other spaces that I think for a lot of them were started or fostered by people who I can't diagnose, officially if I haven't met the people, but I will say narcissistic-like personality disorders, then you have people who think that it is the ideal way to be, to, I think, be disconnected from certain emotions that you have that are like anger or sadness, the kind of emotions that I think narcissists don't want to have to deal with and don't have an awareness of for themselves or compassion towards in other people. So I think they vilify those kinds of emotions and find a way of portraying it, like within Scientology, it's the reactive mind. And that's just this horrible thing, according to the group, that you have to get rid of because it stands in your way, as opposed to it being the source of information, guidance for you, insight about how you're being treated or that something might be wrong. It's sort of like taking away your safety net.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. And I do think those emotions can offer, even if they're maybe unpleasant in the moment, they can or inconvenient to yourself or to the group that you're following, right? One or the other. They can, definitely offer important information about, in a way that something that you might not have realized about your circumstances. So yeah, I totally agree with you.
I wonder also about the overlap with cultic systems here. And one of the things that I notice, and I was talking to someone who is an NLP practitioner who I value and I think has a good conscience and, you know, wanted to sort of teach me more about it because I wanted to hear from someone who practices it. One of the things, among other things, that I found a little cult-like about it was this rapid rapport and trust building, because it wasn't dissimilar in my mind from the love bombing that people get when they're in cultic systems or the mirroring techniques where you feel like you have something in common with the people there and they relate to you and they understand you, but it's all very purposely done. And the issue for me, among other things, is that it kind of fast tracks trust. And when you fast track trust, you naturally, I think, bypass caution and discernment and picking up on red flags. I was bothered by that even from when she started talking about what she does with clients, because I thought maybe that's not something that should be rushed in that way.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I think you're pointing out that that a main quality of NLP is not just rapport, but also build sort of rapport tricks to get into rapport with someone quicker. Like, for example, you can this is harder to do over Zoom, but if I were with Rachel in person, I could be noticing her breathing patterns, trying to match my breathing patterns to hers. You can mirror body language. Some of this is very intuitive things that we do with other humans. Like, I think mirroring is something that a lot of people, do very unconsciously and is very natural. But there's something strange about the way that NLP tries to sort of break it down to create this hack where here's how to get into rapport with anyone instantly, even if maybe the situation is a little bit uncomfortable or unnatural. Like, how do you go past that? And it is really interesting, though, because I think it's not a clear binary between using rapport in a natural way and using it in an unnatural way. Like, you must know this with people that you work with all the time. Like, this is a critical skill. And like, if you don't eventually get rapport with someone, they're never going to talk to you. And it creates a lot of friction in a dynamic. So it is just interesting how NLP sort of sought to create a kind of method and a quick fix to techniques that are really like present and sort of like basic social skills. And I think, I don't know if I, just to make a little bit of a bridge, the phobia cure, the NLP quick phobia cure, I don't know if you've researched that at all.
Yeah, although I'd love for you to talk more about it. I don't know enough about it to be able to get into teaching an audience about it. I'd love you to.
Yes, I can explain. And this is another technique, just to quickly contextualize, that I feel like is actually, from what I've read, sort of from clinical psychology and papers from within, for example, CBT, there are similar exposure therapy methods to work someone through a phobia, but NLP does them on a stage and they promise to do it in 10 minutes, right? Like, and Tony Robbins has similar claims. So that is something that's so interesting to me, where it's like, okay, you are basically having someone in a context that is pseudo semi-therapeutic confront like a snake, or maybe it's a fake snake, or maybe it's the idea of a snake, and they're doing a guided meditation and they're confronting the snake. Like, none of that is wrong, but then like to sell tickets to this, to make it a spectacle and to claim that this will be, you know, immediately cured, is sort of a bit suspect. At the same time, I'm sure they're also trying to harness the placebo effect by telling people, yes, this is going to work, don't worry. So there's something interesting there about time and speed and that aspect of the NLP promises.
Wow, so interesting. So yes, so I want to come back to that. And first to say, when we're talking about mirroring, I could see, you know, when I was studying, my undergrad was in special ed. And so we didn't have the term for it then, but now it would be called co-regulation. That there is something about slowing your heart rate down, slowing your breathing down to help calm someone else down that is very helpful to them. And it's much more successful than telling them to calm down, because I saw a meme that said, never in the history of calm down has someone calmed down when you told them to calm down. But I think that also there is something about the intention there. My intention is not to control. It's to help someone not be as agitated so that they're not suffering to the same degree. And let me see what I can do to lend something, even subconsciously, to them, again, with a certain intention. And if the intention is that I need this person to trust me ASAP, I would sort of wonder, you know, what that's about, to trust me to do what and why does it need to happen so fast? And that there is a speed with this that I don't know if it really matches how humans operate and how emotions operate and fears are ameliorated. But going back to this idea of being able to help with fears, it is so appealing to think that you can get over something in 10 minutes. I can't imagine not wanting to sign up for that. And at the same time, what we know about when things are done in a public forum is that, yes, there's the placebo effect, and yes, we don't want to undercut, right? And I'm sure you're not. It's a very powerful thing. And if a placebo works, yes, please, let's have it. At the same time, because I've been doing this for 35 years, there are so many people who have come to me who have said, I said that I believed. I said that it was working. I wanted to believe that it was working. I may have even believed it at the time, but I knew that everyone was looking at me. And everyone else was smiling and excited for me. And I didn't want to be the only one in the room that this wasn't working for. So there is so much about the social psychological piece, the influence there, the encouragement to pretend, I think, to a certain degree, that where I don't know if people who are NLP practitioners are aware of how often that might actually be happening. People don't want to stand out. And I've told many people many years, if they are doubting if this is working, they're never the only ones in that space who have the same doubt. So even if people have a smile on their face, it doesn't mean that they're feeling it or getting it also. So I wonder, you know, how much we make space for people just wanting to fit in.
My best guess would be that Richard Bandler, the co-founder of NLP, who we interview in our podcast, would say something like, yes, I know that maybe the person is playing along with the audience, but that's part of the method. Play along till it's real and pretend that it's real until it's real. Right? Like, and also, is behavior the same? Like, I think there's a sort of behaviorist bent to it where it's like, well, they're not acting afraid of the snake, so it worked, right? Like, even if inside they're maybe feeling something different, well, they're able to deal with it. They're here in the room. They're not behaving as if they're afraid of the snake. So therefore, the phobia cure worked.
Oh, that's so interesting. Okay, so teach us more about some of these techniques and also what your concerns are.
I mean, I would like to maybe shift gears to just sort of share one theory that I developed while researching NLP and thinking about the ways that NLP has been used in people's lives positively and then also more maliciously, trying to sort of tease out, you know, what's the difference and how far can these techniques really take you? And I do think that the Nexium example is quite interesting because, so I think, and twin flames is relevant too, because I feel like a lot of these methods of sort of getting people to behave a certain way in the context of a somewhat controlling group, they get you so far, but where they become really dangerous is when they are combined with things like sleep deprivation or appetite suppression, or in the case of Nexium, blackmail. When you're talking about harnessing rapport and emotional co-regulation, but using it with a malicious intent, that can get you a certain result, but I don't think it's the thing that makes people agree to things that ultimately they really, really regret. Like, I think it has to be combined. And unfortunately, in the cases of true malicious use, is often combined with techniques that really wear down a person's agency. And so I think, I don't know if you agree with that. I would be really curious to hear, as someone who has also thought about these topics a lot, what you think about this idea that I had doing this project, this theory that I've had.
Right. So it's reminding me, and maybe this is an odd thing because I have allergies, which you could probably tell if you can see me sneezing and doing other things. I think about histamines in a weird way here, because they'll say that sometimes when you have allergies, if you're exposed to one thing, it might impact you, it might not. But the thing that makes you have a full-blown allergic attack is often multiple exposures, because your immunity has already been triggered and it's been knocked down over and over again without you realizing it. And so by the time you get to have watery eyes and you're sneezing and really miserable, there's probably a lot that has been done to you just by you walking by something that you may or may not know that you're allergic to, or petting a cat or whatever else. And that then it doesn't take as much, I think, to just have you and have your system fall apart. So when we reach this crescendo where we don't have defenses, it is often because not only are we sleep deprived and food deprived, which was done in such a cruel way in Nexium, and for such a sick reason, but I think also being under constant pressure, like you had to be on all the time and you had to be at the ready all the time and have your phone and be able to say ready, you don't get to rest. So even when you had your small little bouts of being able to rest, you really couldn't. You had to have your phone on and be ready. And also having this sense inside that there's something wrong with you if you're not going along with it, if you're not seeing that it's great, because that already causes this internal tension that I think is exhausting in its own right. So I absolutely know where you're going with this. And I think it's very true that then you have this perfect storm and people don't realize that they have had their hands sort of tied behind their back tighter and tighter, and then are really at the mercy of these techniques.
Yeah, that is super interesting. I completely agree with what you say about the repetition. And also, I think it's important, like the repetition and the sort of insistent battering of multiple different techniques to wear someone down. I think that's what often gets missed when, like, sometimes in pop culture, like, we want to call everything a cult. And like, I think when you actually look at groups that use these techniques to achieve like really shocking ends and a crazy level of control over people's lives, it is like it's really different, like how they're using these techniques in repeatedly over time and all together.
And I think, you know, one of the things when people will say sort of what is a cult and how is it different from other things, you know, it's disorienting sometimes because cults love to define what a cult is so that they don't fall into those categories. Like, you know, ones where you can live on your own, they'll say, well, cults are a thing where people live communally. Sort of they'll point out whatever they aren't. And that's what a cult is. So I don't go by their definitions. But one of the things is that it becomes your whole life. And this is now your whole community. And this is your funnel of information. And so it's all around you and you can't get away. And so then you are a sitting duck in so many ways. And it's, I think, ultimately so disrespectful, especially because you're not told ahead of time that this is what they're doing to you. So you can't make an educated decision about protecting yourself from it because you don't know what's happening. What else can you share with us about the show and about what you're hoping to be able to get across to the audience? And I love that you're highlighting this for people.
We go into detail of the techniques behind NLP. We try some of them. You can learn about them and see if you've witnessed them before. Maybe you've come across something similar. Listeners may recognize certain elements of NLP techniques in other contexts that they've been familiar with. So I think that's one interesting part of the show. The other part is just simply a really wild bit of cultural history that isn't known of how, you know, someone who Richard Bandler was a college student, an undergraduate when he developed this technique, and how he managed to sell it to the U.S. military of all places, as well as, you know, all of these other contexts, just how it kind of grew and spread, I think is a really interesting sort of bit of American history that people can learn about. And finally, I do think there's an element where people can learn how to use these techniques in ways that might fit their therapeutic modalities or also protect themselves against the malicious use of these techniques.
Thank you so much. And where can people find the show? Just so people want to check it out.
Sure. Mind Games is on any podcast app that you like, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio. We got it.
Nice. Thank you. And thank you, Alice. And people also check out her other writings about other groups. And I love that you cover these subjects. Of course, I care about these things deeply. So it was a pleasure to talk to you. Hope to talk to you again.
Yes. Thank you so much, Rachel. Thank you for your work. And thanks for this interview.
One more thing before you go. Thank you so much. It was so wonderful to learn so much from her, and I cannot wait to be able to have a listen to more of the episodes of the Mind Games podcast, where I get to hear Zoe and Alice, who you got to know a little bit today, discussing the issues with a practice that has the potential to be helpful and the potential to be harmful. There is an interesting kind of coexistence here, and sometimes a blurred boundary between help and control. And if the intention is to help, then great. And if you find that it's really helping, then great. But if your intention is to control, then not so great. And a lot of people will say to me, you know, is it the technique that's the problem when you get involved in a cultic group, especially one that uses psychoeducation or psychological techniques or self-help techniques? Is it that, or is it who's running it? And often it is the person who's running it and their intention, their need, their ego need to control. And then you can look at the techniques and if they are harmful or helpful. But very often it has to do with how they're used and why they are used. So the concern that I have with things like NLP, among other things, even with hypnotherapy or mindfulness practice or however things are going to be used, sometimes in a helpful way and sometimes not, is that it can teach influence in a largely unregulated space. So when tools are designed to shape perception and behavior, and they're taught without a strong ethical framework, and sometimes you won't know if it's being done without an ethical framework, they can be used to either empower people or to override them. And for those already inclined towards control or grandiosity, it's a powerful and potentially dangerous combination. Now, I want to be clear that there are many people who see me after they have been really mistreated and misused by therapists who are not using NLP techniques and are not using other kinds of techniques that one would see as potentially problematic or that override people's boundaries and their feelings of being able to resist what's happening. And still, people can be harmed because the person in charge wanted to not embolden them and strengthen them, but to disarm them so they could take over. And so people, sometimes without degrees, but who call themselves clinicians or counselors or healers or a lot of other things that are unregulated terms and labels, but also people with many initials by their name, many degrees, still can do quite a bit of harm because that's who they are and that's what they need. And so it is important to note that I do talk about this. I talk about this a lot on the podcast. I have videos on my website about seeking healthy therapy and how you know that you're in a healthy system with a healthy therapist and how you know you're not. And I really want people to be safe because it really, really is frustrating to me when people finally get the courage or the resources or the time and the commitment to go for therapy only to find themselves with someone who's taking advantage of that role and taking advantage of that power. When we look at NLP and other kind of systems that are pushing people, I think, to lower their boundaries, you have something that I talked to her about, which is this idea that you can have rapid rapport and trust building. And Alice talked to me about that and about how that shows up within NLP. And, you know, I see it a lot in large group awareness trainings. And then you have the bypassing of critical thinking, which I think is potentially problematic. Within cultic systems, you have information overload and contradictory messaging and thought-stopping techniques. And within NLP, I believe you have what's called pattern interruption and embedded suggestions and things that can cause that kind of confusion. And so I think when people are getting disoriented, and it's happening also at a fast pace, people can be more suggestible and compliant. Now, if what you're trying to do is help them get past something, help them get over something, help them have insight about something, then having them be suggestible to that is a good thing. But if you're just really wanting them to be in a situation where they have lowered their defenses so that you can affect them more, because that's something that you have a need to do, your own ego need to do, then that's when it can become dangerous. And again, you don't need NLP techniques to have that intention. But you, as the person who is being done to, you want to kind of get a sense that the person who you're working with is going to be respecting and adhering to your boundaries. If you say it's going too fast, if you say no, and if they shame you, or if they say, well, then it's not going to work, then it might not be the right modality for you. The other part that I think is important to notice is that within cultic systems, and I think also within large group awareness trainings, and also within NLP, there's a reframing of reality. Like, instead of thinking that something is a failure, they will say that's growth. And they'll change the narrative kind of quickly. Cults do this. They redefine suffering as showing that your life has a purpose. Without suffering, you're not showing that you really are someone who can devote themselves in a way that's even painful to a cause that they care about. Or recasting exploitation as somehow something you are training for in order to be committed to the work, when really you're just kind of making money for the group. There is also this idea, though, within certain modalities, and I've seen it in NLP and again, others. And I say that to not vilify NLP, but just to say what is possible here and what is possible in other forms, too. And these are just things that you want to watch out for. When someone says that they are the ultimate authority, and when someone says they have somehow special knowledge that you can't get anywhere else or through any other modality, that's just not the case. And so you will notice with some practitioners, they will come across like they have advanced insight into the mind or into your mind. And like within a cult, The leader has the exclusive truth, the path towards enlightenment, and you can only find it here. And the only way to access this one truth is by showing your devotion, or again, by lowering your defenses and not saying no to anything you're told to do, or not saying no when you're told to get more involved. There's also a speed with which this happens. Now, some people really want to have a transformation that happens over a weekend or during a week. And I understand that. That would be incredibly wonderful to be able to have kind of some sort of healing that happens within sort of the microwave age at microwave speed. But when you're looking at change, can it really happen instantly? Sometimes change can, but not always. And can phobia cures happen in minutes? Sometimes, I suppose, if it's what you are needing and if it's just the right thing for you and just the right technique, but not often. And within cult recruitment, they will say things like, your life is going to change overnight, or your breakthrough experiences are also somehow framed as permanent. This is going to fix you permanently. And sometimes breakthroughs are just not like that, because you're caught up in the moment, in the fervor, sometimes even in the mania of that moment, and you have a release of chemicals in your system. And as Alice talked about, the placebo effect, it can make you feel like you're getting over something and that you're feeling better and that you're getting cured. But you might find the feelings start to creep back and the fears start to come back. And it doesn't mean you did it wrong. And it doesn't mean that somehow you weren't committed to getting over it, or whatever might be put back on you as you being the fault of it not working. But it could be that that technique is just not something that works permanently. And it's good to know that ahead of time. And so if you're promised a miracle cure and it's a permanent cure, may or may not be. And just be careful not to blame yourself if it doesn't work. There is something that we need to talk about too, which is autonomy. Healthy therapy preserves your autonomy. Healthy organizations preserve your autonomy. Healthy relationships preserve your autonomy. That means you have the choice to make decisions for yourself. You can say no, you can say maybe, you can say later. You don't have to make a commitment. You don't have to defer to another person. You don't have to give over your decision-making to another person. You don't have to give up what you think is your goal for yourself to what someone else thinks it should be. You get to still be in the driver's seat of your life, and you get to use a therapy technique or a therapist or even a guru, someone who might be a healthy guru, as someone who's an adjunct to your life, not someone who you have to hand the reins over to. And so the concerning use of control is when it overrides your autonomy, when it bypasses what you really feel and what you really want, when it's controlling, when it's manipulative, and when it pathologizes your doubt and your questions, or the fact that it might not work for you, that somehow that means there's something wrong with you. And it doesn't mean that at all. And so be careful when going into any kind of technique. Find out about not only the technique, but your susceptibility to giving over sometimes too much power to another person because you want the magic to happen. We all do that at different times in our lives, but just notice it if you're someone who is more open to suggestibility, if you're also more open to the person in the room who's very slick or who's very sure or who has the answer or who says they have the only answer and that they can cure you and fix you. Make sure that you have healthy skepticism. And make sure also that if it doesn't work, you don't buy into the idea that somehow that's because you didn't approach it the right way or you didn't really want to get better, which I find to be very insulting way that people are responded to when things don't work. So stay safe out there and be a good and smart spiritual consumer and a good and a smart therapeutic consumer. And if NLP works for you, then great. And if it doesn't, just know there are other techniques, there are other choices, there are other ways to go. There always are. Thank you to Alice, and check out Mind Games Podcast. Be well.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Are you healing from manipulation, narcissistic abuse, or coercive control? I created something for you. It's called the Restore Journal app. Built from my decades of experience helping survivors recover, this trauma-informed app is more than journaling. It's a guided healing space to help you process what happened, reconnect with your voice, rebuild self-trust, and create healthier boundaries for the future. You can move at your own pace through all of the sections, and it's a multimedia healing support designed for different learning styles and needs. There are three tiers, including one that offers you full access to my video and audio library. If you're ready to feel understood, supported, and move forward with more clarity and strength, the link for the app is in the show notes. Take good care.